Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks very much for listening this week, and we will cover several topics this time around. Later in the program, the Department of Veterans Affairs just announced it's cut its backlog of pending veterans disability claims by more than 40%. We'll get the American Legion's take on that announcement and several other issues related to VA benefits. And later in the hour, DOD has decided to make its own rules with regard to how its contracting officers buy from the very important GSA schedules. First, though, we've heard over and over again that the leadership skills you learn in the military make you a great candidate for a private sector job once you get out. It's a nice idea, but it's not exactly true that every departing military member walks into a solid civilian job the day he or she leaves active duty. And the military has more work to do in terms of making sure its departing service members are ready to enter productive private sector careers when they leave uniform service. Erica Jeffries is the Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Excellus. Along with Korn Ferry and Points of Light, her firm has set up a four-month individualized training program to help veterans get their arms around the value of the leadership skills they've gained in the military and how to market those to potential employers. The application window for the second round of that program is about to close.
The main objectives for the Leveraging Military Leadership Program are really to help veterans who are transitioning from the military or who have recently transitioned in the last 2 years accelerate their career path in the civilian sector. So that could mean anything from translating their leadership skills that they have learned while in service to the country into characteristics and skill sets that will be applicable to corporate America or to any other career path that's civilian oriented.
And so talk about that translation process, if you could. I mean, obviously, these are leadership skills that are valued by a civilian employer in the private sector. What's the translation that needs to happen to take that leadership that you learned in the military and make it applicable in the private world?
Well, what we found, and myself being a veteran as well, I've experienced it firsthand. After being in the military, there are so many things that you do on a day-to-day basis that you don't recognize are actually applicable to corporate or to civilian jobs. Things like managing budgets, managing people is a huge one. In the military, you often think of these things as just your duties, just your additional duty or just your job, your day-to-day, but not realizing that these skill sets are actually coveted capabilities that people are looking for in civilian workforce employment. Things, like I said, like managing people and managing budgets and managing production lines and leading soldiers or leading troops, I mean, the leadership aspect is tremendous. And when military people do their day-to-day work, they're thinking of it just as their dedicated service and not realizing that these are much-needed skills that employers are seeking day-to-day, every day.
But I guess my question is, why don't those, you know, military-acquired skills map one-to-one into the private sector? Why is this additional translation that you're talking about something that's necessary?
I think oftentimes the skill sets do map one-to-one from the military, but more often than not, the transition can be difficult because often military service members don't know exactly what the employer or the employment world is looking for. So that's where the translation piece comes in, and that's what makes the Leveraging Military Leadership Program so helpful, is because we spend a lot of time talking about what you've done in your military career and then culling out the actual characteristics and aspects of what you've done in your military career to what you want to do in your civilian life. So that translation or bridging that gap is really what helps to accelerate soldiers or service members in their transition, because they can then see clearly, here's what I did every day as a military service member, and now I understand how what I was doing actually translates into benefits for civilian employers. We spend a lot of time in the program actually focusing on what your purpose is, what your passions are, and then helping to shape those purposes and passions into a 30-second elevator speech or into a one statement of purpose for that particular service member to say, here's who I am, here's what I do, and here's what value I can bring to your particular workforce. So that's a real key element of the program that actually may sound simple, but takes a good bit of time to really think about what is it that I do, what is it that I bring to the table, and how can I be value added to an employer on the civilian workforce side.
So to put that in a nutshell, would it be right to say that it's really more about marketing the skills that you already have and identifying them within yourself rather than teaching these individuals how to be a leader in the first place?
Absolutely. What we've discovered is that the leadership aspect is part of the fabric that makes up these wonderful men and women that have served in our country. But in addition to finding what it is that lies within themselves, we're also helping them to think about, where do they want to go? How do you take the characteristics that you already possess and the attributes and capabilities that you already have and leverage them into a successful career in the civilian world? I think what we often find is that we don't realize what skills we already have. And when you're leaving the military, it's a huge inflection point in your career. So you're going from your, whether it's been 3 years, a 3-year enlistment or a 33-year career of service, it's still a major inflection point in your career, and it's an opportunity to continue in the same path, in the same vein where you've been going, or it's an opportunity to do something entirely different. And I think all too often, not just service member, but anyone who is working is typically thinking about their particular career track and not realizing that the world is your oyster. And that's really the message that we try to communicate to our participants in the Leveraging Military Leadership Program, is that this is an opportunity to do whatever you want to do. This is a key turning point in your career, and you can go from where you are today to wherever you want to be. I remember when I was getting out of the military, my mom reminded me, you can do whatever you want. And hearing that was actually overwhelming and almost daunting to me. And so this program is helpful in that it helps you to narrow that sky's the limit basket of opportunities that is out there to what you really want to do, and help you to accelerate your career in that vector, in that path.
There's obviously going to be a limited number of slots that you're going to be able to fill within this next session of the program. First, tell us what that number is, and then what sort of the selection criteria is. What sorts of folks make ideal candidates for this program?
So we have expanded our participant pool. We had over 100 applicants for the first cohort, and we accepted 35 participants for the program. This time around, we're going to accept 45 participants, and we have already started receiving a great number of applications. So we are really, it's a tough thing to have to narrow it down to choose the actual cohort. Part of the criteria that goes into choosing the cohort, it's like I said, it's any rank. So in the first cohort, we had from corporal to colonel, and so any rank, any number of years of service, the criteria, basic criteria, are to have either exited the military within the last 2 years or planning to transition out of the military within the next 6 months. Those are the only basic criteria that we have. In addition to that, we do have an application, which is a series of about 5 essay questions that just asks the applicant to tell us a little bit more about themselves. What is their reason for wanting to be part of this program? What do they think their future looks like in the next 5 years or 10 years? Where do they see their career heading? What's their career path? Asking questions like that on the application helps the participant or the potential participant to really think about, why do I want to do this program? Where do I see myself in 5 to 10 years? What do I want to do with my career now that my military service is complete? And sitting and thinking about those things and actually writing it out is really the compelling story that we use to determine who the best applicants are to participate in the cohort.
This is a 4-month program, so it sounds like it's relatively in-depth. What else can you tell us about what the selectees will go through during the course of that 4 months?
Well, there is a 3-day in-session, in-residence portion of the program is how it kicks off. It starts with, actually, before the in-session program actually starts, you do meet with an individual coach. So every participant in the program is assigned a certified executive leadership coach that will help them work through their resume, work through preparation for interviews, and several other aspects prior to even coming to our first in-session or in-residence classroom experience. So from meeting your coach, you'll have an initial assessment. You do a 360-degree assessment as well, where you ask your peers to fill out surveys about who you are so that your coach can get a better understanding of how you relate to your team members, your subordinates, your superiors. And they have an initial discussion before coming to the in-residence portion of the program. Then we spend 3 days over a weekend, a Friday, Saturday, Sunday of in-depth, you know, full days talking about, like I said, the purpose, the passion, the career trajectory, preparation for the next step, and doing the whole work that is required to help translate the military experience into the corporate civilian experience. Then the 4 months that goes beyond the three-day in-class session is the individual coaching that is provided by executive leadership coaches from Korn Ferry International, who work individually with each of the participants to help them map out their next steps for moving through their strategy. Because during the classroom session of the program, we begin to outline what the strategy looks like to get you from where you are today to where you want to be as you transition into your corporate or your civilian role. So the coach then helps that participant walk through that strategy of, and helps them to implement that strategy over the next 4 months as they figure out where they are moving through the strategy to get to where they want to be in the civilian workforce. So the partnership between Korn Ferry is critical to this program because the executive leadership coaches and the professional development coaches that the participants are assigned to give that continued support over the next 4 months after the program continues to help them navigate their strategy and implement their plans for success.
As you said, this is the second time around for this program. What can you tell us about, if anything, about what the outcomes were for those first 35 folks who cycled through? I mean, did they go on to get successful jobs after having participated in this?
They did. And one of the things we discovered in the first cohort is that clearly not every participant needs the same thing. So this cohort, we have created different tracks for our participants. So there were some participants who actually were already gainfully employed when they came to the program, but they wanted to figure out how to get promoted or how to continue to have success in their current employment. Then there were others who had absolutely no idea what they wanted to do, who had come out of the military or who were transitioning out of the military, who not only didn't know where they wanted to go, but didn't really know what skills they brought to the table. So we have developed 4 different tracks that will help the participants to navigate their own success based on their particular needs. Looking back at the first set of participants from the first cohort, it has been overwhelming to hear some of the conversations and to see some of the comments on our LinkedIn page about how successful the program has been and how impactful it was for our participants. It's so gratifying to me as part of, you know, the facilitation team to hear the comments coming back from some of our participants. Yes, we had some people get jobs with top-tier consulting firms. We've had people negotiating for promotions within their current fields. We've had people just saying that they feel so much more empowered to go out and do what they want to do. So while not listing specifically the companies and types of employment that people got after this program, commentary has been overwhelming with regard to the impact that it had on people with regard to their personal growth as well as their professional experience and growth.
I can imagine someone listening to this and saying to themselves, you know, it's great that this program exists, but why does it take basically a corporate volunteer effort to do this for 45 people? Isn't it the military's job to get people set up for success after their service? I wonder if you have any views on that as a former Army officer. A, whether the military has improved its ability to get people set up for post-military life, and B, if what you're doing can offer any lessons to what they should be doing.
Sure. Well, there are programs that exist within the military for this purpose, to help military service members transition from the military to their civilian sector workforce or just to civilian life. That being said, one of the comments that we heard more and more throughout our program was that program that the military offered just didn't provide the individualized support that we provide in the Leveraging Military Leadership Program. The programs that the military offer are very good. However, they are very broad brush. They are one size fit all, and they don't necessarily meet individual needs that transitioning service members actually need. So I think that's one of the best attributes of our program is that while it is somewhat selective, it's a lot smaller. There are a lot of individual interactions with the participants, as well as the coaching that goes on before and after the three-day in-session program, which really allows that participant and that service member to get that individualized help that they need, because there is no one-size-fits-all solution for the transition that takes place between leaving the military and going into whatever your next stage of life will be. So that's, I think, the best aspect of this opportunity, is that it really helps that service member say, here's what I want to do, here's where I want to go, and we then walk them through a strategic plan of how to get to where they want to be. And then we continue to walk with them, like I said, for that additional 4 months as they implement that plan, which can be really the hardest part.
And I guess the last clarification I'd have, which I don't think we covered, I just want to make sure that the cost of this is entirely underwritten by Excellus and Korn Ferry, right? There's no cost to the applicant?
There is absolutely no cost to the applicant. The program is entirely free. The only cost that the applicant would incur if they are selected to be a participant would be the travel to the actual in-residence part of the program and their lodging. We were very successful during our first cohort to be able to secure some free and then severely discounted lodging through partnerships with hotels in the area. However, our participants are required to pay their own travel to get to the D.C. metro area for the in-residence portion of the program.
That's Erica Jeffries. She's the Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Excellus. Her firm, along with Korn Ferry and Points of Light, are running the second edition of their no-cost Leveraging Military Leadership Program. They're taking applications through April 16th. We will post a link to more information and the application itself at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. Time for our first break, and when we come back, another veterans topic. The Department of Veterans Affairs denounced recently that it's cut its backlog of disability claims by more than 40%. Reaction from the American Legion on that in just a moment. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
Welcome back to On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Well, earlier this month, the Department of Veterans Affairs announced it's cut its backlog of disability claims by 44%. That's from the high point of 611,000 backlog claims back in March of last year. VA says that's proof it's making progress against the backlog, and it's on its way to making sure no claim is older than 125 days by the end of 2015. But VA observers point out there are other problems in the Veterans Benefits Administration, and some of them, like the backlog of claims appeals, are getting worse, not better. Zachary Hearn is the Deputy Director for Benefits at the American Legion. He talked with me about the VA announcement and several other issues related to veterans benefits.
I think that it's a combination of a couple of efforts by VA. The first is the nationwide implementation of the fully developed claims process, which really kicked off in August of 2012, and the American Legion joined with the White House and VA in a joint effort to implement this program nationwide. And the reaction from the veteran community, from the VSOs, and to assist VA in this process has been significant in helping reduce the backlog. Secondly, the one-year and two-year-old claim initiative that started March of last year also led to the shrinking of the numbers in the backlog.
And as they focused on those old, is there other work that's not getting done or getting done less well?
Well, the American Legion conducts regional office visits nationwide. In fact, right now I'm on one in Phoenix, and we do see a discrepancy between VA's accuracy numbers and what we review the claims as, and what we determine the accuracy is, and it's the way that VA reviews their cases and determines their numbers are just different than the way that we do, and so that's obviously a concern of ours. I think secondly, what also has come up out of these provisional ratings is that in some cases, veterans are being told, hey, you need to submit this evidence and we'll review it as long as you do it within 1 year. It doesn't even really qualify as an appeal. or you can't even appeal it. And so what it does is you created an end product by doing that in VA's work credit system. So it did help in reduce the numbers, but it really didn't truly address the problem. So what you'll have is an outstanding claim, but you haven't really reached an end game yet. And so that's a concern that we also have. So while I certainly appreciate the focus that VA has had on the 1 year and 2 year old claims, but when you look at what the appeals backlog situation is like right now, and it's increasing, the number of appeals in the pipeline, whether at the regional office or at the Board of Veterans Appeals, that also causes us a little bit of concern, because it goes back to A, the way that the claims are adjudicated at the regional office, and B, the question continues to exist if the VA employees are receiving the proper training to properly adjudicate these claims.
Let me make sure I understand something you said just a minute ago. So is what you're saying that, let's say there's a case that has seven or eight different issues in it, you're saying that once VA addresses one of those issues, adjudicates one of those issues, they are then counting that entire case as out of the backlog?
No. Let's say a veteran has a multiple issue case, and in the provisional rating it says currently you do not have this, and we've seen cases of this. There were several cases that came out of the West that were like this, where they said, we don't have the necessary evidence here to grant you the current benefit for disability, or the disability benefit. But if you submit this evidence, we'll reconsider it, but you need to submit it within 1 year. Well, what that did was that cleared it. That case at that point was taken off of the backlog, that number. So if you had 300,000, now you have 299,999. However, once you do that, the veteran really hasn't moved anywhere forward in the process. And historically, at least over the last several years, when a veteran was stuck in the backlog process, you received a letter that said VA is continuing to work on your claim. Please understand that we have a backlog. You've changed the language, but the fact still remains: the veteran is still hanging in limbo with regards to the claim, because no final decision has been rendered by VA.
Got it. So they're basically just creating more work for themselves down the road, even if they're calling it provisionally resolved, if I've got that right.
Right. And again, I can't stress this enough. We appreciate the efforts that VA is making to improve to address the backlog, but if all you're doing is just shifting the cases around, then that's not really resolving the problem. It's just spreading it out over a bigger field.
Take me into the weeds a little bit further on the discrepancy between what you're seeing on claims accuracy and what they're saying. That the number they had as of yesterday was 91%. What do you guys think is more reasonable?
Well, a lot of the times, the way that when we go and we look at regional offices, and we look at it from the perspective of the veteran. Is a veteran receiving the proper benefits? Now, let's take, for example, a veteran has files for five conditions, say flat feet, two ankles, two knees, and two hips. Now, if the veteran is denied on all five, and they go back and they say, well, you should have granted the flat feet, what could have occurred is that those ankles, those knees, those hips, they could have manifested secondary or have been aggravated by those flat feet. But because VA doesn't do that, what they'll say is, okay, fine, you should have granted that, so we're gonna put a tick there saying that you were wrong on the flat feet. But what needs to occur is a comprehensive review of these claims and an understanding that other conditions can manifest secondary to a previously service-connected condition. Now, VA will do that. They'll do that frequently, but they won't do it enough, or they won't do it unless the veteran specifically asks, secondary or aggravated, even though the case law and regulations support that VA is supposed to be doing this. If you look at our Board of Veterans Appeals unit, roughly 75% of the claims have been proven to have been inaccurately developed and prematurely denied at the regional office, or just out and out aired, where VA denied them and the benefit should have been granted. And you combine that fact with OIG and various outside agencies reviewing VA claims processes, and VA is the only one that's sitting there saying, no, our numbers are statistically accurate, and they use an outside third party to do that, and I understand that, but you could have the best weapon in the world, but if the bullet you put in the barrel is lousy, you're gonna have a lousy shot. What our problem is that we don't think that VA considers their claims from a holistic perspective, from a comprehensive perspective. Instead, they're using a multiple choice exam when a blue book exam needs to be utilized. And so as a result, that's where I believe that the discrepancy in numbers comes about.
That's Zach Hearn, the Deputy Director for Benefits at the American Legion. We'll come back and spend one more segment on the VA disability backlog after another break. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbia. Thanks for being with us. One more segment this hour on the VA benefit system and the department's recent announcement that it's cut its claims backlog by more than 40%. Our guest for this is Zach Hearn. He's the Deputy Director for Benefits at the American Legion. What's going on from your perspective on the appeals backlog? I think the number they had at the end of 13 was somewhere north of 900 days on average to take an appeal end to end. Why has that gone up so much?
It's several reasons. First is that if you look at the number of claims that they adjudicated over the last year, anytime you're going to adjudicate more cases, you're obviously increasing the odds that you're going to have more appeals. The second reason, I think, is that you, at least in the case of the American Legion, we've got 2,900 accredited representatives, and they're well trained, and they will speak to the veteran and say, we think that this was wrong. And so if you've got more people saying, hey, this was wrong, they should have adjudicated it this way or that way, they didn't consider a particular regulation or a certain case law, then it encourages other veterans to appeal. My understanding is that the Board of Veterans Appeals handles roughly 1-1.5% of all appealed of all claims in the VA process each year, but I think that those numbers are startling. That only 25% of the time VA is getting it right at the regional office, at least from the perspective of the board. I'm not saying that's really what their accuracy rating. I'm not saying that at all.
So in the universe of claims that are appealed to BVA.
To the Board of Veterans Appeals, 1 out of 4 that the American Legion adjudicates were properly denied, according to the Board of Veterans Appeals. But that doesn't include also, you have to remember that claims can be appealed to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Now, I don't know what the number is there, that how many times the court overrides the board. But it's not just simply claims that were denied, but claims that were improperly rated. In other words, if a veteran was receiving a 30 or 50% rating for a condition and should have been rated at 70%, and that's appealed, and then the board says, yeah, it should be at 70%. So it's not just strictly an up-and-down grant or denial. It's the level of disability that VA also fails to oftentimes assign properly.
What's your read on how well VBMS is working? I mean, how glitchy is it as far as you can tell? How much is it helping?
It's too early in the process to tell right now. We've worked very closely with VA in this process. I believe every Thursday they have a teleconference that all VSOs, and they are keeping the stakeholders involved in this process. We've had moments where we've debated certain issues, and even internally within VSOs, we've debated certain issues. And so it's too early really to pass judgment, but we are keeping an eye on it. Actually, right now, some accredited representatives with the American Legion are receiving training here in Phoenix on VBMS. This is the first time that we've actually utilized the program when we've gone out and done the regional offices, because before we had to use the old case file system. But we've heard mixed reactions from our accredited representatives, and I think some of it is that anytime you implement a new program, a new computer program, you're going to have glitches. You kind of have to let it bear out a little bit to see what areas need to be improved, and I think that's kind of the stage that we're at right now.
And then let me go back to the fully developed claims issue that you mentioned at the outset. Since the department has made more of a public push to get veterans to submit fully developed claims, what kind of surge or non-surge or whatever in interest have you seen from the veteran community to come forward to a VSO like you guys to help them out with that?
Oh, it's been enormous. I remember when we were talking about it right around Thanksgiving in 2012, we were hoping to get we were hoping to get between 15 and 20% of all veterans that we represent to submit claims via FDC. And now it's somewhere in the neighborhood, I want to say between 25 and 30%. So it has started to get out there. And for veterans who are trying to seek service connection for presumptive conditions, say diabetes, heart disease, lung cancer that served in Vietnam, it almost creates an automatic fully developed claim. For a person who's trying to get an increased rating for a disability benefit, that's almost an automatic fully developed claim, as long as the veteran follows the rules about how to apply and sticks to the rules. And so that's obviously a huge benefit for a veteran, because they can go back to 1 year as a financial incentive and give you up to 1 year worth of retro benefits. But also the veteran receives the benefits faster, and that's huge. If a veteran's sitting there below 50% and comes back with a 50% or higher disability rating, now free health care access is available for everything outside of dental, but it complies with the Affordable Care Act. If you're over a 30% disability rating, you get special hiring rules for federal employment. If you've got a 10% or higher disability rating, you don't have to pay the funding fee on VA mortgage. So it's not just the dollars in the pocket, but it's across the board where it can affect people in their lives that nobody really thinks about until they sit down and they say, wow, these other benefits, vocational rehabilitation, if you have over a 30% disability rating. These are all different programs that are out there for veterans, and so we want to make sure that veterans are A, getting the right benefit, and B, that they're made aware of all the different benefits that are out there, and the fully developed claims process gets that benefit to the veteran much faster than if they go through the traditional process.
On the broad overarching goal of ending the backlog by 15 and getting their accuracy to where they want to be, do you care to handicap how likely it is that they'll make those two goals, and what are the things that might stand in the way of that?
Well, I'm not going to put any Vegas odds out there on it. I will say this: the American Legion is more than willing to work with VA to see that this objective is met. It does no good for us to be opposing each other. We're both on the same side. We're trying to get veterans the benefits that they've earned through wearing the uniform. But we need to make sure that it's done properly, and we need to make sure that veterans are receiving claims that have been properly adjudicated. It's a balancing act, and I can respect that fact, and the American Legion respects that fact, that you've got a lot of veterans that are seeking disability benefits, but at the same, and we want to get these done as quickly as possible, but at the same time, we want to make sure that they're done correctly too. You don't want somebody who's receiving a 30% disability rating really should be receiving significantly more. And veterans, a lot of times they're not experts on veterans law, and unless you work in this field, you probably wouldn't want to consider being one. It's just one of those things that you're going to take the word of the government sometimes, and that's why we want to make sure that the veterans are getting it right, because the veterans have worn the uniform, they've worn the battle, and we need to make sure that they're receiving the proper treatment that they've earned.
Zach Hearn is the Deputy Director for Benefits at the American Legion. He's joined us to talk about the backlog of disability claims at VA and the department's assertion that it's well on its way to eliminating the backlog entirely by 2015. One more break and we'll finish out the show this week on another topic, DoD's decision to make some changes to how it buys from the GSA schedules. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Back on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. We'll close out the hour this week with a little bit of analysis on a recent DoD decision that's been a bit puzzling for members of the defense contracting industry, particularly those who sell via the General Services Administration's Schedules program. DoD moved last month to require all of its contracting officers to make their own determinations about whether items are priced reasonably before they buy from the schedules, even though GSA has already made those determinations. Alan Schvatkin is the Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council, a group that represents service contractors. since this is a deviation, why don't we talk about exactly what it is we're deviating from? I mean, what's the status quo prior to this deviation being issued in terms of fair and reasonableness on the schedules?
One of the bedrock principles in the Federal Acquisition Regulation for the schedules is the determination that prices that are put on the schedule are deemed to be fair and reasonable. GSA goes through a significant negotiation process with companies. It's not a head-to-head competition. It's between the companies and GSA. But in establishing those prices, GSA makes the determination then, the FAR makes the determination that the prices are fair and reasonable, and therefore a contracting officer doesn't have to make any other determination, not only on that contract, but on orders placed under that contract.
And would it be fair to say that the whole reason GSA makes those fair and reasonable pricing determinations once for the entire government is one of the key reasons the schedules exist in the first place?
It is certainly one of the best selling points that the schedules have because it adds to flexibility and ease of use. And so the schedules were designed to provide that flexibility. It is one of the early strategic sourcing and initiatives that the federal government has had.
I guess one of the key questions is what level of effort would you expect this to add to any purchase of items that are on the schedules if KOs and DOD have to make their own determinations?
Well, the process is not a difficult one. Contracting officers make it every single day on every other type of transaction, other than on the schedules. And the DOD deviation makes it very clear that the amount of effort and the documentation that's going to be required will vary based on the type of the procurement. But it will require the contracting officer to take action and do some market research on work that they haven't previously done before. It'll be hard to say whether that'll have a significant increase, but every time you add to the administrative burden in the contracting process, you run the risk of some contracting officers say, too hard, let me look at something else.
And so could you see this potentially driving business that's currently going to vendors on the schedules, you know, elsewhere, sort of lessening the value of being on the schedule?
I think that's one of the key concerns that I have is that it will lessen the value of the schedules where there is reasonable competition elsewhere, where agencies have multiple award contracts or other vehicles already in place. The schedules have always been a very convenient and very flexible tool, particularly as they've migrated those schedules from products to services and now to solutions. The schedules are still a challenge to work for certain kinds of applications. But I think this now adds another element to the decision-making process that DOD contracting officers will have to make before they'll choose to use the schedules.
Well, to play devil's advocate then, I mean, if DOD or any other agency can potentially get a better deal off of the schedules, or you know, in other words, not using the schedules, isn't that a good thing from the government's perspective?
Well, it is a good thing, and that's why the FAR provides specifically that contracting officers and agencies are encouraged to seek discounts off the schedules. The whole purpose of those specific orders, and we see that in place today on blanket purchase agreements and other kind of individual orders being made on the schedules where there are further price discounts based on the dollar value and the period of performance that be requested. So it's not like the schedules are inflexible. There's only one price to be paid. But you're absolutely right. There, as we've seen example after example in other strategic sourcing initiatives, there are always opportunities for an individual purchase to get a better discount than a volume purchase agreement that may be put into place, whether it's by GSA or any other agency. We see that on the office supplies at GSA. We see it on soup at NASA. We see it elsewhere as well. So this is, again, the trade-off between lowest price on a spot purchase versus volume discounts and ease of use across the board, whether it's on the schedules program or any other multiple award contract.
I know you obviously can't speak for the department, but is there anything in terms of the timing of this deviation? I mean, schedules have been around for so long. Why now, I guess, is the question. Any insight into that?
I think the nature of what is being purchased today on the schedules is changing. The Air Force is now using a lot of the OASIS contract, rather as sort of a hybrid or an offshoot of the Schedules program. I think more and more we're seeing the Schedules program still stuck in some of its history and not able to evolve fast enough to meet the evolving needs of the agencies. And of course, there's heightened sensitivity with the budget reductions to drawing the lowest price available for the right solution. And I think all of those things are coming together to create an environment where DOD says, at least I need to reevaluate and make sure that the prices we're paying off the Schedules purchases are the best we can get.
That's Alan Chvotkin, the Executive Vice President and Counsel at the Professional Services Council. By the way, we covered this issue in detail in our most recent edition of Inside the Reporter's Notebook. You can find that at federalnewsradio.com. We're also scheduled, by the way, to talk soon about this with Richard Ginman, the co-director of DOD's Office of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. Stay tuned for that conversation on an upcoming show. That's it for this week's edition of On DOD, though. Very glad you could join us. Thanks again for listening. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.